Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is endorsing Senator Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nomination. The State Department fired two employees for improperly accessing Obama's passport records. And stock prices end a holiday-shortened week in the plus column after the Federal Reserve took dramatic action to shore up financial markets. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, syndicated columnist, former editorial page editor of The Washington Times, Tony Blankley, syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune, Clarence Page, and chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, Ken Walsh. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Dan.
Ken Walsh, this week, really, the government took extraordinary steps to bolster the economy. For example, created a new $200 billion lending facility, allowed brokers, not just banks, to borrow funds, and threw an emergency wreath to Bear Stearns. And finally, on Tuesday, it cut short-term interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. Any indication that these actions are going to calm the credit crunch?
Well, I think the Fed is taking these actions are really almost unprecedented, certainly in recent years. And I think that particularly with this Bear Stearns bailout, where the Fed is offering to back up about $30 billion in mortgage debt that has been accumulated, that's an amazing thing, because you have to wonder, when does it stop, and how many other of these kinds of things can be done if the economy is in as bad shape as these actions indicate that it is. So I don't think we know how well this is going to work. I mean, you know, the markets are going up and down. It's incredibly volatile, and a lot of it is sort of uncharted territory. So we really don't know.
Tony.
Well, there's a lot to be said. The big question is, are we experiencing a liquidity crisis in the financial markets or a solvency crisis? If it's a liquidity crisis, that is short-term lack of cash in the system. Now, the Fed can pump money. That's what they're doing. Hundreds and billions of dollars they're pumping into the system. That assumes that that will keep the companies that are illiquid liquid enough to keep the system going. But if the underlying assets are in fact below the liabilities of these companies, then you have a solvency crisis for which this liquidity flow will not solve.
But do we know?
And we don't know, because the market has not yet determined the actual value of those houses that have not yet been foreclosed on. Your bank, you own a million mortgages, or and you don't know whether those houses are going to sell for 80% of what they were originally worth, or 40%. Until the market determines the real market value of those assets, we don't know the financial solvency of all kinds of institutions. The other piece that's happening is that the Fed is trying for the first time to get cash to institutions that traditionally have not been regulated by them, the brokers and the intermediating. That's what they did going through J.P. Morgan to Bear Stearns. And they're showing a lot of creativity.
What about Barney Frank's proposal, Clarence Page?
I was afraid you were going to ask me about that, because I'm not really that
familiar.
Let me talk about that, because funnily, although Barney's a liberal and I'm a conservative, I did a column in which I suggested that what he's proposing, before he proposed it, might be necessary, which is to start figuring out how to protect, stop for having all these millions of homes being foreclosed on and going into the market. Two reasons. One, because of the pain, of course, it causes the individual homeowners, but worse than that is if you dump millions of houses onto a market, you are going to crash the value of all housing, and that's the major asset that most Americans have. So there's a real value in at least seriously considering stopping that from happening.
Ken.
Yeah, well, this, we talked sort of in the macro sense at first, but now, and you look at the point of these distressed mortgage holders, these distressed homeowners, that's where a lot of the country is right now, you know. Don't really understand these big pumping of money into the system issues, but there are millions and millions of homeowners who are defaulting on their loans and are in danger of losing their houses.
And that's where it comes home to roost.
Exactly. And that's where Barney Frank's proposal is, and that's where there's a lot of conflict with the administration, where the President Bush, talking to people at the White House just this week, was saying, look, let's not get stampeded here. We might make things worse. We might cause housing prices to increase unfairly, and the market is going to be disrupted. So you have this situation where the big investment banks and so on
are getting help,
and then the average, or, you know, to the extent
there's a reason for that, because we don't really know. Just as we don't know the value of the housing property, we don't know the value of Bear Stearns, firm itself. If it were to go entirely belly up, and it went bankrupt last year, would that in itself would generate so many lawsuits and all, and a tremendous tangle because folks have their pension funds tied up in it, et cetera. So give it enough money to keep it afloat so that it can continue to function and prevent the whole system
but
from caving in.
But what is the administration's problem with, at the same time, pumping $10 billion into helping individual homeowners pay.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where the administration is, but their inclination is not to intervene. Now, the problem is that all of the burden of trying to keep us from sliding into something terrible economically is being put on the Fed, as opposed to also on the taxpayers, if you will, through actions by the executive and legislative branches of our government. And I think, by the way, that a lot of the presidential campaign is going to be focused on whether which of the two parties is prepared to take more bolder action. Clearly, the Democrats are going to call for bolder action. So far, McCain is following the traditional Republican line of sort of letting nature take its course economically. I don't think that's going to be a winner this season.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that you are seeing a lot of these proposals percolate in the Democratic-controlled House and Senate now. And, I mean, one argument the administration makes is that, you know, people did decide to get into these mortgages themselves. Maybe they didn't look at the fine print. Maybe they were treated unfairly. But there's a certain responsibility issue here. So how far do you go? But then on the other side, you have the big companies had their own responsibility issues, too. So, but there is a perfect storm of a political issue here percolating, as we're saying, in the campaigns, because the Democrats are going to say, we need to help sort of the average person,
sure,
not just the big companies.
I would really like to have somebody tell me how many of these outstanding mortgages were done by speculators and how many of them were actual individual homeowners.
Well, in general, the speculators were a smaller percentage.
Smaller.
In fact, this crisis with the subprime mortgages is ironically the downside of a good idea, which was to expand the market to get more people, lower income people, but still, working folks, get them into home ownership. There were brokers who were exploiting this, pushing mortgages on people who really couldn't afford them, not telling them about the fine print, some downright unscrupulous activity. A similar thing happened to FHA back in the late 60s after LBJ passed the National Fair Housing Act and all, and they expanded FHA to help more black and Hispanic homeowners come into the market. And we saw a boarded up housing occur in Detroit, Chicago, and other cities because of the same kind of rampant exploitation of a good idea. They cleared that up, but now we got the same kind of thing happening with subprime mortgages.
Clarence Page, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, Ken Walsh of U.S. News and World Report, and syndicated columnist Tony Blankley. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. One last question on the economy. What are the current indicators telling us about where we're going, Tony?
Well, I mean, the job suggests we're trending downward, the economy's trending downward. Inflation is up only in energy and food. It's not up and below that. So there's some ambiguity whether we're looking at inflation. And the Fed has to make this judgment carefully because their effort to liquefy the financial markets it can also feed inflation. So they've got conflicting interests to try to manage. And the inflation indicators are ambiguous at this point. But we're obviously near the end of a mature recovery. And we're probably going, most people believe, we're going into at least a shallow recession, and some think it could be a lot sharper, including obviously Alan Greenspan, who thinks we're looking at the sharpest contraction since, as he politely put it, World War II. But what he really meant, of course, was the Great Depression, because World War II was an expansive period.
And what this means, again, to everyday people is it's not abstract. It's gasoline prices,
absolutely,
home oil,
food.
And food. Those are the basics, and
retail sales are sluggish.
Terribly.
And oil
off.
Fell to below $100 a barrel yesterday, and people were celebrating, which tells you something about when we're celebrating oil falling below $100 a barrel.
But there's some studies indicating that if it is the inflation in gasoline, in oil, and food, that affects more people, and so the inflation rate for everyday people might be more than the statistics might indicate. The economy that people are feeling might be worse than we might be even getting from the statistics.
I walked into a small women's dress shop yesterday that I do frequent, and they told me sales are absolutely flat. Mm-hmm. Very few people walking in.
Yeah.
It's hitting everybody.
That's another indicator. Restaurants and Winnebago sales, always a leading indicator. They're down.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the week in politics. Stay with us. Welcome back. Here for the Friday News Roundup this week, syndicated columnist Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, Tony Blankley. He's a syndicated columnist, former editorial page editor of the Washington Times. He's author of the book titled The West's Last Chance. And Ken Walsh, he's chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Clarence Page, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, the only Hispanic governor, is endorsing Senator Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nominee, calling him a once-in-a-lifetime leader. How much of a boost is this for Obama?
Well, first, the timing is great for Obama because he's had this terrible week of dealing with the backlash from the from his pastor's videos all over the internet. And Bill Richardson, until now, has played things nicely neutral as a candidate, seemingly running for vice president, even though he's denied it. He would be a great vice presidential pick for any of the Democratic front runners. And so he's been very nice to Hillary Clinton and to Barack Obama. But he's taken a stand now. New Mexico's voted, but at a time when superdelegates now are weighing, shall I go with Hillary, shall I go with Barack, this helps firm up many of them as far as their resolve for wanting to go with Obama.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm not one to think that endorsements, bring constituencies with them, except rarely. Maybe Oprah can do that, but I'm not sure Bill Richardson can. But certainly, as a Hispanic, as Clarence said, is important, and the superdelegates factor. Also, I think it took there's going to be a certain amount of gratitude to Bill Richardson by Obama for changing the subject during this very difficult week Obama has had, and it took a certain amount of political, guts for Richardson to do this now.
Tony,
along with Gore and Edwards, this was the other third of the major endorsements that hadn't yet come down.
Why?
Well, because they're bigger figures with constituencies. But I have to say that the value of it would have been vastly higher had he done it before the Texas primary with the high Hispanic vote, or the California primary with the high Hispanic vote. There were very few Hispanic votes left in the Democratic primary process. So the fact that the Clintons were able to freeze Richardson into silence through the key Hispanic voting periods of the primary could be seen as sort of a tactical victory for the Clintons, even though Obama wins the prize of his endorsement.
How
finally.
Do we know he was frozen?
Well, we know that Bill Clinton was heavily lobbying him, you know,
right.
hung out with him and sort of insisted on watching the Super Bowl with him. All the reporting is that he was intensively trying to stop Richardson from going where everybody thought he was going to go eventually, which was Obama. And they succeeded in holding him off through the key primaries.
Tony, what do you make of the fact that two State Department employees have been fired for improperly accessing Obama's passport file? What were they looking for?
Of course, we don't yet know whether they were their own agents, whether they were working for the Republicans or for Hillary. I mean, those are sort of the three options. They were on their own just out of curiosity. They were people who were doing it to pass information to Clinton, or they were people doing it to pass information to the Republicans. We don't know what they are. I did note with interest, although it's ambiguous, that a few weeks ago, the Clinton team made the point that Obama, for all of his international interest, has never traveled abroad except to Africa and to Indonesia. And of course, now we find out that this information was available. How would they have known 3 weeks ago that he'd never gone to Canada, he'd never gone to Mexico? So, I mean, while it's an ambiguous point, it does raise the thought of, were these people scurrying through the files? Now, there's a long, ugly tradition of going through files. The Republicans went through Bill Clinton's passport files in 92, trying to find out whether he'd gone to the Soviet Union or Vietnam. He hadn't. But so going through the files, of course, the Clintons themselves went through FBI files. They had mine back in the early 90s. So it's disreputable, but it is a tradition of American politics.
Yeah, a couple of other quick points. One is, what would they be looking for? Well, where did he go? Was there some sort of strange or nefarious connections there? Or the Muslim, this whole Muslim rumor that's been percolating around. I mean, Barack Obama is a Christian, but there's this rumor around that he's a Muslim because of his name. And so maybe they're looking for something there. I mean, but the other thing is, it strikes me that there's this vast opposition research system that operates in politics today, that you never know where it starts and where it ends. I was just talking to somebody from one of the Democratic campaigns who said, we don't really know what the other side has about us, and they don't know what we have about them, or what the Republicans have about the Democrats. So, who knows what all this was designed to get.
And as you said, this all comes in a week where Barack Obama was addressing real concerns about his pastor, the Reverend Wright. Do you think that Obama's speech quelled the controversy there, Clarence?
Well, I think you have to pick your metaphor. I think that it stopped the bleeding, in my view. I think that was a number one thing that he had to accomplish with that speech. We see now a Gallup poll, for example, that was taken, just so happens, in that four-day period before the speech. You could see a divergence suddenly of the polling, Hillary going up, Barack's numbers going down. I think from the initial reaction that we have seen, and I believe Fox News did an initial snap poll that showed there was some relief of his pain, shall we say, at that time. The question is, though, what's happened is the reviews overall have been spectacular for him. People say great speech. A number of prominent conservatives has said, brilliant speech in so many ways. At the same time, that it didn't fully answer the question, as far as skeptics are concerned, as to why he stayed with Reverend Wright for 20 years.
I think that's haunting him. Will that decision not to repudiate Wright haunt him?
I think it haunts him with the people, first of all, folks who are never going to vote for him and looking for something to pick on him with, which is happening with a lot of conservative high-profile critics. But people on the fence, Reagan Democrats, those moderate voters that Barack Obama needs to win over, to win states, it's a real problem for them, and he's got to deal with that in some way, I think.
Ken, how have his political opponents acted to his call for Americans to really confront race relations?
Well, I mean, in the sort of the elite media, in academic circles, and, you know, of all political stripes, I mean, people, I think, generally welcome this notion of this dialogue on race. And that's generally, I think, what Barack Obama was trying to do here. And the speech alone, I think, could argue did that. It did open a new way of more candidly looking at things, both from every perspective, really. But I think the other part of this is, you know, the details. Once you get these videos, once the videos came out, and this issue of Pastor Wright has been out there for a very long time.
Months.
You know, Chicago media have done a wonderful job in covering this. But now, with these videos out there, that rivets this whole thing. Even though the sound bites perhaps don't reflect the broad totality of the pastor's views, this is what rivets people. And what you're getting from a lot of the Hillary Clinton side is, while they don't want to touch the race issue that's radioactive for them, it's the vetting. It's that what else is there in Barack Obama's background that we don't know? They've been saying this for months.
So was Reverend Wright a factor in Hillary Clinton's widening her lead in recent polls, Tony?
It may be. I don't think much about these head-to-head poll, notional polls for 7 months from now. But here's the central thing. I think he's potentially very badly damaged himself. It's not what the media says or us pundits, because it's on the Internet. It's in the... If this election in the fall is about the economy, health care, Iraq, the Democratic nominee wins. There's no doubt about that. If this is about race relations, the Democrats probably lose. Because when Obama said yesterday about his grandmother, his white grandmother, typical white person, which is, if said in the other way from another race, would be considered bigoted, you tie that with why he was spent 20 years listening to this preacher, right, say his hateful things about America. And that's going to be all through the Internet. It's going to be by 527 advertising. It's going to be on talk radio. If the public thinks that they're electing a man who is going to lead this country into a fight over race relations, he's going to lose.
Seems to me he's not leading people into
fight.
Tony makes a good point. In my book, now out of print, but as long as I'm not plugging it, back in 96, the book on race relations, which I had a chapter on race and politics, and said precisely that the issue is race, Democrats lose. This is in the national presidential races we're talking about. When the issue is the economy, Democrats win. And when the issue is class, Democrats win. I think Tony is saying that to a large degree. What happens politics is a battle of perceptions. You have not just the oppo teams, but you also got spin doctors who try to change the conversation to a way that advantages them. Until now, Barack Obama has deliberately avoided specifics on race because he knows as long as he was talking in generalities about let us come together, he has benefited tremendously. Once you get into specifics, you start getting into those points of tension that drive blacks and whites apart. And by the way, I saw another poll that showed on the question of should Obama leave the church, something like 80% of black folks said no, something like 60% of whites said yes, which is like the O.J. Simpson divide.
So how is this going to affect Pennsylvania, where he's already lagging behind Hillary?
It's the old Jim Carville observation that Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh at one and Philadelphia at the other, Alabama in the middle. Very conservative, small-town folks, good people. I've been there many times, but that's where your Reagan Democrats are, who are least likely to vote for him. But if Barack can pull out those big numbers around Philadelphia and the suburbs, he could conceivably carry that state.
What about as the race goes forward? Is this racial thing likely to continue, fostered and pushed by his opponents, or is it likely to fade?
I think it goes on. I mean, if you look at this, the states coming up, there's every reason to think that this is going to continue. And I think that remark that Tony mentioned about the typical white person, just, you know, a lot of people will just sort of roll their eyes and you know, think, well, you know, how could he have gone into it that way and sort of stumbled into another, you know, stereotyping people that way in this supercharged atmosphere? So, no, I think this goes on, and it's a dangerous thing for him.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen one poll that shows that Obama in Pennsylvania is getting 36% of the white vote. He's got to get 43-45% at least, even assuming he gets 95% of the black vote in Philadelphia. So we have to see whether these numbers persist, but they're very dangerous implications.
Okay, let's turn now to the 11,000 plus pages of Hillary Clinton's daily calendars from her White House years that were released. What did they tell us about her role as the wife of President Clinton, Kent?
Right. Well, you know, I covered the Clinton presidency, so there wasn't a lot new there because a lot of the coverage has now gone on to things that if you looked at the coverage at the time, we all knew. It's reminded us that after the health care issue, Hillary's role diminished. And you know, there was good reason for that, and that's what happened. You could see that in her schedules, but you saw it at the time in the things she was doing, because that when the health care plan failed, she was in charge of that, and that took a lot of the energy and the focus from Hillary Clinton, and she realized that she had become a negative for Bill Clinton.
How much of this 11,000 pages has been redacted?
Oh, gee, an awful lot. I mean, there's a lot of, within the pages. And there are some days that still are not there. There are things like, we all, when we're looking at these things, looked at sort of the Monica Lewinsky year. That's probably what every investigative reporter looked at first. And there are areas where, you know, times when you don't know what she's doing. But there's a lot of it redacted. They say for privacy reasons, but Bruce Lindsay, who's Bill Clinton's longtime confidant, supposedly went through every page, every line, to decide what should actually be released.
So is there pressure to release more?
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think this hurts her much. Look, I mean, she's doubtlessly slightly overclaimed her expertise and her role in government. But the fact is that she was in the White House. She was around. Compared to Obama, she does have more Washington and White House experience. And so maybe this kind of undermines a little bit. Her problem isn't this. Her problem is that even though in the primary she may, by August, be the stronger candidate, the Democratic primary process is moving along in such a way, and Obama is so far down the track that she may not be able to, they may not be able to switch to Hillary, who may be their stronger candidate.
Clarence.
Well, the Obama campaign is combing through these papers, of course. The one thing they've already pointed out is that from their point of view, it shows that Hillary Clinton was very much involved in NAFTA and was a proponent of it. This is something that's been argued back and forth. But, you know, in those blue-collar states like Indiana, Pennsylvania, NAFTA is still an issue, and it's something that we see coming out now. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're possibly going to see coming out of those papers.
Hillary Clinton trails Obama and pledge delegates. How could she still win the nomination and now that the revote efforts in both Michigan and Florida are down the tubes,
Well, how
Tony?
She can technically do it is the superdelegates can do anything they want until they get to the floor of the convention. No matter how, they can commit to one or the other and change their mind, and they have enough votes to decide who's going to be the nominee. Obama is not going to have a majority of the pledged delegates, the elected delegates. The challenge is, if they find later this spring or summer that she's a stronger candidate, can they, in their own political interest, because they're all public figures, most of them are politicians, congressmen, senators, governors, can they vote what they judge to be the party's interest, which may be Hillary, as opposed to the sort of the sentimental favorite, Obama, because of the tremendous vote he got in the early part of the campaign?
What about Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen's proposal for a two-day superdelegate primary for June after the last voter primary so that you don't have this argument at the convention? Claire.
Well, this is one of a number of ideas being floated to try to avoid a train wreck at the convention. I don't give a lot of faith necessarily to this particular idea, although, you know, we will see. But I think it does show the Democrats' big concern right now is to have that nice infomercial of a convention that we've been come accustomed to since, I'd say, at least 84. 1980 was more of a nightmare where you had Teddy Kennedy walking off the stage instead of shaking hands with Jimmy Carter, and that was indicative of the kind of split that occurred, and the party's worried about that this year.
Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back. We'll go right to the phones. Let's go to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Lucy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling regarding accessing Senator Obama's passport records. It seems to me that during employment orientation, you are informed by your superiors what is appropriate and inappropriate behavior and how it would be dealt with. So it begs credulity that all three of these employees were unaware that their behavior was inappropriate and carried consequences. And secondly, if there was a breach and the State Department knew about it in January, you would think at the very least there would be a memo, a meeting, informing employees that there has been a breach and that we will not tolerate any further breaches. So I'd like to know how unlikely is it that there really was something very, very innocent about this breach.
What do you think, Ken?
Well,
and the Obama people did not learn about this until day before yesterday.
Right, and they are very, very angry about this. Yeah, I think Lucy, the caller, makes some very good points here. Now, these were contract employees. They weren't like State Department officials.
But so they nevertheless had access to those records.
And, yeah, and in fairness, they have been fired now. But there was an interim period here where it was all kept in-house. And there are a lot of suspicions about this. And, you know, it's being described by the State Department as sort of excessive curiosity on the part of these people. That, I think, is
pretty
the best.
Pretty lame.
Yeah, the best
pretty
possible.
Pretty lame.
But that's a scandal,
that's the best
too,
spin
of course.
Yeah, of course.
Who else are they looking into in their idle moments?
Precisely.
There, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, what do you make of it, Clarence?
Well, you know, I used to think that if the burglars are caught too quickly, then that shows that they're real amateurs. And then Watergate came along, and it turned out to be more than a second-rate burglary, as the White House initially had said. We just don't know. There's going to be a lot of questions, obviously, already being raised about this, and I think it's not going to go away right away.
All right, to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Tom. I hope you're not serious.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and thank you for this show. No, I'm being a tad facetious, but my point is that I think all of our legislators and economic experts are missing the point. But the main thing is that everyone else is missing the point, too. I'm divorced, a contractor, although unemployed. I have two small children. I've been telling my wife for 5 years, you have to stop shopping at Starbucks. I can buy a month's worth of coffee at the store. And so that's the situation in a microcosm. People have not been looking closely at their own situation. What's so sad right now is that I have a $300,000 life insurance policy. I'm working on a ladder 3 stories up. I could fall off this ladder, and my family would have $300,000, a lot more than I'm going to be able to provide for them, even though I am employed. And I think a lot of people are in this situation, but I also think they're in denial.
Tom told our call programmer, Dory Annisman, that he was on the verge of suicide because of the economic situation. He has said he was exaggerating, but nevertheless, he puts into a nutshell the way a great many people in this country are feeling, Ken.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, looking beyond the numbers, that's why I think there's this, you have this tremendous increasing number at 7, now close to 8 out of 10 Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. And there's these other startling numbers now about the famous Ronald Reagan question, are you better off? More and more Americans don't feel they are. In fact, they're much worse off now.
You know, for Tom and for other listeners, it's very important when they get into that frame of mind to get their thoughts beyond the moment, which may be very hard, and think through to where a better place that they can be in the future. I mean, when he was talking about the ladder, it was very disturbing to think that, I mean, I know people think that way when they're under economic stress, but it's so important for them to understand that that can be resolved, friends, that somehow they'll get through the economic mess, and they want to think about a better future and keep pushing forward. I mean, it's very important.
And this certainly shows how much of a gut issue that economics is at election time for your average American out there.
Now, here's an email from Tiffany, who says, as an African-American woman who's native to the south side of Chicago and grew up in the shadow of Trinity United Church of Christ and the ministry of Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright, I must attest that the characterizations of Reverend Wright as a racist and hate monger and the labeling of Trinity UCC as some type of cult church are totally and utterly false. The negative.
I can speak to that. I can speak to that. I've been to Trinity Church, and I have not talked to Reverend Wright. I mean, before all this flap occurred, before I even knew it was Barack Obama's church, I was there first for a wedding, some friends of the family, and then later on, just because he was such a fascinating preacher. And I can understand, just my personal level, why Barack Obama was surprised by this backlash, because the kind of thing I'm seeing in these videos is not the guy I saw up there
really?
At that podium. No,
really?
You know, this is a very scholarly gentleman and an ex-Marine at the same time, a guy who's worked in and out of the Muslim community, who knows how to speak to the underclass and the upper class in Chicago. And that's what drew me to the place. For one thing, Diane, it's an American tragedy that we have so few young black fathers in church. You go to your average black church, and you're going to find a lot of women. You're going to find old folk. You're going to find children. You're not going to find that many younger men. And this at that church, you do. And Reverend Wright, some of this, you know, is what we call signifying in the community. He knows how to combine some of the more ethereal theology and the history of Christianity and Africa and African Americans in an appealing way to lure young black folks away from the nation of Islam, to lure them over to Christ. The same way he brought Barack Obama, who was more of a studier of religion than a religious person himself until he met Wright, brought him into it as well, because Barack was a community organizer. Wright, like other Southside ministers, were important to that network of effort. And they told him, you know, you need to have a church home, Barack. You can't just go in here and talk to ministers if you don't go to church yourself.
Is there some indication that as the Reverend Wright neared retirement, his rhetoric became more and more outspoken?
I think it was the other way. These videos are mostly old. I mean, 9/11,
really?
That was 7 years ago. And who the heck wasn't talking crazy in the week after 9/11? I mean, I give them a break. This is the reason why you've got this OJ-like divide between blacks and whites around this. Wright is not just the Chicago figure. I've been surprised how many folks around the country, especially black intellectual circles, know him. He's about to speak Dallas, but Fort Worth, and they've already called for extra security, and they've moved the location of it and all that. But this was arranged before this whole flap arose, because he is a guy.
All right, let's take a call from Mark in Detroit, Michigan. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to say that, ask the panel if they could imagine Hillary Clinton or John McCain giving the speech that Barack Obama gave on Reverend Wright and race and politics in America. I mean, Hillary Clinton, and the whole Clinton legacy is that they won't admit that they've ever done anything wrong. And John McCain, I've never heard him utter the word race, so that's my question.
All right, Ken Walsh.
Yeah, well, you know, you can imagine maybe a Bill Clinton coming close to this in other, you know, in his earlier years, but no, not Hillary Clinton or John McCain. But that's part of the appeal and the opportunity that Barack Obama offers. He comes from this diverse background. He there's a moment here that a lot of Americans are sort of yearning for, and going to his rallies, people want him to be the real thing.
Here's an email from Bob in Rochester, New York. He says, Barack Obama's speech called on the nation to have a high-level conversation on race. Much of the media has dropped to the lowest level and focused on trying to drive controversy. Cable news has been in the dirt. The media can drive the conversation. Why not take the high road and do something good
Amen.
For the country.
Well, first of all, because I cannot conceive of a national conversation in the atmosphere that this country exists in staying on the high road. We've seen this presidential campaign immediately go down to the low road with Bill Clinton raising the race issue in South Carolina. When race comes up and is discussed nationally, it's always ugly. It always has been. Now, sometimes good comes out of it, out of the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
Something good
exactly.
came out of it. But that's a multi-year process. For Obama to have now during a presidential campaign, a long public discussion on race is to guarantee that he's not going to be president. He can't possibly want it.
Do you agree with that?
I agree. It's a
formidable
atmosphere.
Task.
Actually, I think it's to Barack Obama's advantage that this is breaking now and not say
later.
After he was a nominee in the middle of October. You know, there is enough time now.
Do you think he made a mistake in making this speech on race?
He said himself that his white advisors said don't do it, and his black advisors said do it. And I can see how that would happen because black folks are more comfortable talking about race.
But also, he was in a very dangerous position here with these videos getting out there. And I think he really needed to make the speech. And the other thing is, to the caller's point, you know, so many people you hear the media do this or that. The media are so fractured. In this world we're in now, the media can't control a story like this with the internet, the web. This just gets out there and there's no way to restrain it.
All right, let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Drew. You're on the air.
Hi there. Briefly, I just wanted to address those last comments about Barack Obama's speech. I think it was appropriate to do it now, and I think it hopefully will allow him to say, I've said everything I have to say about race and move on. But the reason I called, I just wanted to talk about the value of inspiration a little bit. We as a nation, as an uninspired nation right now, are facing enormous issues in Iraq, the economy. These are not going to be dealt with if we're as disengaged as we've been. And I don't think any of the other candidates are capable of inspiring the nation to do the hard things that need to be done in order to move forward in these times. I'm just wondering if anybody has any comments about that.
Such as talk about race, Clarence.
Well, you know, I think Barack Obama's speech was not the end of the conversation. It's the beginning.
Right.
But folks who say, well, he didn't solve the problem. No, he don't solve a problem like this with one speech. But he changed the conversation, I think. And I think he got in front of the conversation. It is a treacherous one. Tony's right about that. But at the same time, you know, why was everybody so excited, especially white folks, so excited about Barack in the very beginning? You know, black folks were the skeptical ones. But I think white Americans are as eager as anybody else to get out of this racial swamp that we're in right now as far as stagnant discussion goes, and we're hoping that Barack was going to help to get them past that deadlock. Now he's running to it himself.
Can't.
Yeah, and the caller makes a terrific point about this value of inspiration. I mean, we've had charismatic candidates throughout our history as a country. Some of them make it to the presidency, but they think when they do, they find that they need to channel that charisma and that inspiration into practical things, like Ronald Reagan could do. To some extent, some of our Franklin Roosevelt could do that. So you have to have both the charisma and the agenda that you can channel that charisma into.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, Ianessa. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I have some concern about the panel's interpretation of the speech. I recently listened to the speech, and somebody said that he referred to his grandmother as typical white people. And I did not hear that anywhere in his speech. And I think that it might seem like...
That was later, actually.
It might seem like a small suggestion or a small misinterpretation, but given the complexity of this whole situation and that they are so closely tied and that race is such a touchy issue, for all those working people who don't have a chance to listen to the whole speech but maybe tune in here and there to NPR for what's known to be objective news, and they hear that he said, referred to his grandmother as typical white people, that's enough in this day and age to turn people off.
You know, Ianessa, I would recommend to you and to all our listeners that you go to npr.org/national and then go to Obama's speech and read the entire speech. It's long, but it's useful to read it word by word as opposed to getting these little snippets,
but
Tony.
He used precisely those words, not in the speech, but yesterday in a radio interview in Pennsylvania, and it was reported yesterday afternoon in his voice in the recordings on the air now right. of him using precisely those. They were not in the speech. They were 2 days later.
I think that's fair. You know, what's sad is that people don't read or see the speech, and you can see it on the Internet as well, that it was a carefully crafted speech. He deliberately avoided double entendres like that. But, you know, in conversation, I think, you know, as much as I know Barack Obama, when he said typical white person, he views himself as an untypical white person because he's half white and half black. So he didn't see the offense in that Tony and other people hear when they hear that kind of phrase.
Yeah. Right. So I think it's important to clarify that it was not in the original speech, but it was in this. It was actually a sports show, a sports radio show in Philadelphia. And I think Barack Obama was trying to sort of bond. And, you know, the host was a very engaging guy. And they got into sort of almost like a towel snapping moment.
There is, because I've heard it myself, a certain venom coming out of conservative talk radio programs regarding this racial speech, regarding Reverend Wright, regarding the relationship between Obama and Reverend Wright. And you see this continuing, Clarence, mm-hmm. right on up to the convention.
Oh, yeah. You know, race has always been those nice hot buttons like a number of others that can drive up ratings on a show that deals in political controversy anyway. I appreciate honest discussions about this sort of thing. What grates on me is when certain shows, I'm not going to name any but right now, but you know who you are, that had their minds made up beforehand as to Obama and Wright both being wrong, and they are haranguing on this day after day after day. That's the kind of thing that Obama is going to have to deal with.
2 second comment.
In fairness, Obama specifically said conservative talk radio, and he said something disparaging about them in his speech, and he said that the Reagan coalition was partially generated by racism.
Tony Blankley, syndicated columnist for The Washington Times. Clarence Page is syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Ken Walsh is chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Thank you all. And
thank you.
Happy Easter, everyone. Be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.